Bushnell? Kins asked. They have an open investigation and they're farther down the path.
They had a missing persons case, Tracy said. This is a homicide, in our jurisdiction.
That's not how they see it. The way they see it, the husband was the prime suspect and remains the prime suspect.
And they did virtually nothing to prove it. The body was found in our jurisdiction, Tracy said. Why the hell should we give it back to them?
The body was found with a bullet in the back of her head, which means it could have been a body dump, Nolasco said, referring to cases in which the person is killed in one jurisdiction, but the body dumped and found in another.
Tracy seethed, suspecting that SPD, Nolasco, had not fought for jurisdiction. The police department in the jurisdiction where a body was dumped was often more than happy to give it up, especially if it appeared that the case would be difficult to solve and would go on the department's books as an unsolved homicide.
Who cares? It was dumped in our jurisdiction. We have it and we're working it.
At the very least, it should be a joint investigation, Kin said.
Come on, Sparrow, Nolasco said. She was a resident of Portland and she disappeared in Pierce County. Whatever information exists on the victim is going to most likely be in their jurisdiction.
This is such bullshit, Tracy said. She didn't disappear in Pierce County. She was pulled up in a crab pot in King County.
You want to tell the brass that?
Why don't you tell the brass that, she said, no longer trying to hide her anger. That's your job.
Nolasco's eyes narrowed and his nostrils flared.
I'd suggest you stop making every case about every young woman personal. It clouds your judgment.
My judgment is fine. What I want is jurisdiction.
Whoa, Kin said. Let's all take a second here. I think what Tracy is trying to say, Captain, is that we've made progress and we hate to give that up.
Write it up and send it down to Pierce County, Sparrow. This is not our headache anymore. Wrap up what you have going on and send everything down.
Nolasco paused and looked around the cubicle.
Have I made myself clear?
Yeah, Kin said.
Nolasco looked to Dell and Foz, who reluctantly nodded. Then he looked to Tracy.
Do you understand?
No, I don't understand.
But I heard what you said. Then finish up what you're working on and leave this case alone.
Tracy spent the rest of the afternoon fuming. She left the office as soon as her shift ended, her anger building as she drove across the West Seattle Bridge. Dan was out in front of her house, dressed in running shorts, T-shirt, and running shoes. He held two leashes, Rex and Sherlock, prancing and playing. Tracy was glad to see him. Dan had a way of making her forget work when she came home. Tracy lowered her window as she turned into the driveway.
You coming or going?
Are you kidding? I'd never look this fresh if I were coming.
Dan approached the driver's side and they kissed.
I didn't expect you home this early.
Yeah, neither did I.
He stepped back.
Uh-oh. What happened?
Give me 5 minutes to change and I'll tell you on the run. I need to burn off some anger.
Tracy quickly went inside and left all her clothes on the bed. She changed into her running gear and bolted out the door. Dan, stretching, had the leashes tied to the wrought iron fence.
I'm ready, she said.
You want time to stretch? He asked.
She took Sherlock's leash and walked down the block.
I guess not, Dan said, chasing after her.
They walked down the hill to Harbor Way. Running downhill was hard on the dogs and on their knees. Then they ran north, along the beach, past the restaurants and storefronts in the direction of Alki Point. It was a glorious afternoon, the temperature having cooled to the mid-80s, and many people had come out to enjoy the weather. The beaches and restaurants were crowded, and white sails filled Elliott Bay.
You weren't kidding about the pace, Dan said, huffing and puffing. We might kill Rex and Sherlock.
Tracy checked her watch. She'd been running at a 6-minute, 15-second-per-mile clip. She rarely ran 7-minute miles since turning 40.
Sorry, she said, easing off.
Do you want to stop?
No, I'm good now, Dan said after they slowed the pace.
Let's catch our breath at the lighthouse.
Just before the Alki Point Lighthouse, they stopped and took in a view Tracy still found as spectacular as any she'd ever seen. Elliott Bay, a rich blue, the Seattle skyline sparkling in the glint of the sun, ferries crossing. The view and the run had helped ease her displeasure with Nolasco. At least she no longer wanted to rip his face off. Dan wiped perspiration from his face with his shirt and continued to catch his breath.
You didn't say why you're home early, but I'm guessing you're not happy about it.
We lost the woman in the crab pot case.
Lost it?
Pierce County reasserted jurisdiction, and we gave it back to them.
I'm sorry, he said.
What really irritates me is I'm sure Nolasco didn't go to bat for us, didn't even fight to keep it.
Dan gave her time to vent. Then he said, Well, look, it's not often we get to enjoy an early evening like this. Why don't we focus on that?
Yeah, I guess, she said.
Dan eyed her. You're not going to be okay with this, are you?
Not for a while.
Tracy, I know what happened to Sarah makes these cases difficult.
Dan, please, that's not it, okay?
It's not?
No, she paced, frustrated and angry.
Okay, maybe it's a part of it, but the victim was 13 when her parents died. Then she marries a guy who treats her like a doormat, maybe even shoots her in the head and dumps her into the Sound like bait. We make progress, and when we do, Pierce County, which from what I can tell did nothing when they had the case, jumps in and takes it back. And we let them. It's just not right.
No, it's not, he said.
But sometimes you've got to let things go, Tracy. It's like my dad used to say, if you take this shit to heart, you die with a heart full of shit.
That's a beautiful thought, Dan. Very poetic.
She stopped pacing and stared across the water to the skyscrapers.
Dan smiled.
Simple man, simple words. But you can't argue with the logic.
A thought had come to Tracy on her drive home, and it returned now as she stared out at the view.
Nolasco had said to finish up what they were working on before sending down the file.
Are you still going to Los Angeles tomorrow morning?
Bright and early.
I'm thinking of putting in for a personal day and going with you. We could make a weekend out of it.
I'm definitely in favor of that, Dan said. I'll be tied up most of tomorrow in court, though.
Don't worry about me, Tracy said. I'll find things to do.
You see, you're already making lemonade out of lemons.
You sound like a character from Annie. Please don't start singing The Sun Will Come Out Tomorrow.
Dan laughed and sang, The Sun'll Come Out.
God help us, Tracy said, sprinting in the opposite direction.
At home they filled large bowls of water for Rex and Sherlock and gave them each soup bones from the butcher to keep them occupied. Then they jumped in the shower, followed by a short nap. When Dan awoke, he rolled toward her. She had not slept.
You want to go out to dinner? He asked.
Tracy's mind continued to churn through her conversation with Brenda Berg. Berg said that she'd invested in her career, but now she couldn't imagine her life without her daughter. Kins had been right. It had struck a chord. Of course it had. After Sarah's disappearance and Tracy's divorce from Benny, she had invested in becoming a homicide cop and in trying to resolve her sister's investigation. Before she knew it, the years had rolled by, and she was 43, well past the optimal age for giving birth. She rolled on her side, her back to Dan, looking out the sliding glass doors.
Are you ever disappointed you didn't have kids?
Dan cleared his throat.
Where's that coming from?
I interviewed a woman today who just had her first child at 40. She said she'd been focused on her career. Then she met the right guy, and now she couldn't imagine her life without her daughter.
Dan propped his chin on Tracy's shoulder and draped an arm across her body.
I don't know. I always thought I'd have kids, so I guess not having any wasn't exactly how I envisioned my life.
Why? Do you wish you had?
Sometimes. Yeah. Sometimes I do.
Where are you going with this, Miss Crosswhite?
She rolled onto her back, looking up at him.
I don't know. Just thinking if I was going to have a child, it's getting closer to now or never.
The proverbial ticking clock.
I guess.
What about your job? He said.
I could take a maternity leave. And I've done it long enough I don't have to do it full-time anymore, maybe work a split schedule.
Could you still work homicide?
Probably not, but I could work cold cases.
Seems like I'm working cold cases anyway.
Is this because of what happened today, the case getting pulled?
No, I was thinking about it on the drive home from Portland.
Because of this woman you met? Dan said.
In part.
They lay silent for a moment.
Then Dan said, "Have you given any thought to who you would want to be the father?"
Tracy sat up and hit him with a pillow.
"I am now."
Dan grabbed the pillow. He wore a shit-eating grin. "I did have a vasectomy, you know. Remember? First marriage? Wife didn't want children but didn't like the way condoms felt? I may have mentioned that."
Though hesitant, she said, "I've read vasectomies can be reversed."
"I've read it hurts almost as much as when you get snipped. It's not like rubber bands down there."
"I know. I'm sorry."
For a minute, neither spoke.
Then Dan said, "But I would consider it, if that's what you wanted."
"You would?" she said.
He nodded.
"I would, but I think we're skipping a step, aren't we? I mean, Rex and Sherlock are already confused enough. Is their last name O'Leary? Crosswhite? O'Leary Crosswhite?"
"It's O'Leary," she said.
"I'm an old-fashioned girl."
"Are you proposing to me, Tracy Crosswhite?"
"Not on your life. I may be a badass cop, but beneath this hardened exterior is a girl who wants to be swept off her feet when she's proposed to."
"Really? Good to know. I guess I'd better not disappoint."
She snuggled closer to him, feeling the heat generated by their bodies and Dan becoming aroused.
"You, Mr. O'Leary, have never disappointed."
Chapter 18. As big as he was, it was easy to assume nothing scared Delmo Castigliano, but Vic Fazio knew Superman's kryptonite. Del was afraid of the water. Several years back, they'd had a murder investigation in which the killer broke down and told them he'd dumped his girlfriend's body in Lake Washington. Del had been uncharacteristically quiet on the drive to the harbor's patrol offices that morning, and Foz had later noticed him hanging back as they approached one of the police boats. Del had made it on board, but he'd broken out in a cold sweat and spent the day clinging to the rail. The recollection came to Foz as they approached a narrow ramp leading to a dock that served as the sidewalk for some of the floating homes on Lake Union, including the home of the skip tracer they were going to visit that morning. Del stopped cold and went pale, and his complexion had nothing to do with continuing an investigation they'd been told to leave alone. As Tracy had pointed out, Nolasco had told them to wrap up what they were working on, and Foz had already set his mind on the interview.
"You all right?" Foz asked. "I thought you said we were going to this guy's home."
"We are," Foz said.
"This isn't a home, it's a lake. I thought when you said he had a home on Lake Union, you meant he had a view."
"Del, be honest with me. Are you afraid of the water?"
Del swallowed hard and kept his gaze fixed on the catwalk. It was only 10 feet long and spanned just a few feet between the dock and land, but he was staring as if it were a rickety rope bridge spanning a gorge over the Colorado River.
"I can't swim," he said, voice soft.
"What do you mean you can't swim?"
"I mean I sink,"
Del said, now sounding both agitated and embarrassed.
"I mean like a stone. I go straight to the bottom."
"You never took lessons as a kid?" Foz asked.
"My parents tried, but I couldn't get near the water."
"You afraid of sharks or something?"
"No, just the water surrounding the sharks."
Foz had no phobias, but his mother had been deathly afraid of even the thought of snakes.
"You want to wait in the car?"
Del shifted his gaze from the catwalk to Foz. He looked to be seriously considering the offer,
but Foz knew Dell wouldn't let him do an unauthorized interview alone. Dell took a deep breath.
Just tell me the inside is more like a house than a boat.
Absolutely, Foz said. Floors and walls and everything. You don't have to go anywhere near the water.
Except to cross that bridge and floating sidewalk, Dell said, his gaze again fixed on the catwalk.
I'll go first, okay? You just take your time. Foz stepped onto the metal grate and proceeded across. He looked back at Dell as if to demonstrate there was nothing to it. Dell shuffled his feet like a man testing ice on a frozen pond, uncertain it would bear his weight. He paused when he reached the short step down to the floating dock. Foz thought it a strong possibility Dell was going to turn back, but his partner mustered the courage to lower one leg, then the other. Thankfully, the dark-stained Cedar Shake home was anchored 2 slips from the end of the pier. Foz suspected he would have needed a tow line to get Dell any farther. Outside the front door, 12 potted plants seemed to have wilted beyond saving in the unseasonably warm weather. The houses on Lake Union were not like what most people thought of when they heard the term houseboat. Built on massive logs anchored to piers, the homes were not large in terms of square footage, but had every luxury of a home, some exquisite. Their real value, however, came from spectacular views of Seattle. Some sold for as much as $2 million.
"You want to have some fun?" Foz asked.
"No, really, no."
Dell sounded hoarse and swayed like a drunkard fighting to keep his balance. Foz banged hard on the front door.
"Open up! Police!"
He banged hard again.
"Police! Open the door!"
Foz heard pounding footsteps and muffled voices from inside the house. He stepped to his right and looked between the house and its floating neighbor. A man stepped out onto the upper-story deck at the back of the house and flung the contents of a bucket, likely several prepaid phones and credit cards, into the lake. Inside, Foz could imagine Ian Nikolic's wife getting ready to destroy their laptop computer. He hurried back to the door, banged again, and yelled,
"April Fools!"
Seconds later, the door ripped open, and Nikolic looked at them with a bewildered and angry expression. Barefoot, he remained as Foz remembered him, though older now. Reed thin, he wore shorts and a ripped T-shirt. He looked like he'd been struck by lightning, his gray hair frazzled as if electrified.
"Damn it, Fazio, what the hell is wrong with you?"
"How much time you got?" Foz laughed. "You weren't doing anything illegal, were you, Nick?"
Nikolic eyed Dell with suspicion.
"I just threw 3 perfectly good phones into the lake, and Marta was about to destroy my laptop."
"You can afford it."
Nikolic had once told Foz the police came banging on his door on a tip he'd helped a fugitive slip away. Anyone who knew Nikolic knew it to be a ruse. Nikolic refused to work with fugitives, members of organized crime, or people he suspected of stalking. Many of his clients were well known, and the information he possessed, sensitive. He made a healthy 6-figure income, and the first number was not a 1.
"I can afford a Ferrari, too, but that doesn't mean I want to drive it into the lake. What the hell do you want?"
"Need to talk to you about the woman we pulled from Puget Sound in a crab pot."
"She wasn't mine, if that's what you want to know."
"That's where I was going to start. You heard anything about it?"
"Come on in. He got me out of bed. I haven't even had my coffee yet, and I can't think without caffeine."
Nikolic looked again to Dell.
"Is this your bodyguard?"
"Partner.
Dell, meet Nick."
Dell offered a tentative hand, as if any movement would throw him off balance. Nikolic took it, then stepped back, leaving the door open.
"What's wrong with him?"
Nikolic asked.
"He's not much of a water person," Foz said.
The bottom floor of the house was Nikolic's office, the upper floor his personal residence. At the end of a narrow, wood-paneled hallway, they entered a room with 3 desks, multiple computer terminals, printers, and assorted clutter. Filing cabinets lined the back wall. Above them hung a colored print of a man standing in the doorway of a lighthouse, built on a rock that looked to be in the middle of an angry ocean, a massive wave bearing down on him. Below the lighthouse, it said, "Want to get away?" A light breeze blew through an open sliding glass door, bringing the faint odor of diesel fuel and the sound of a boat engine and seagulls cawing. The paddles of a ceiling fan slowly rotated above a barefoot woman standing near the door, sucking on a cigarette and holding a mug of coffee, with the word "Gotcha" on it.
"Sorry to get you up so early, Marta," Foz said.
Marta wore a tank top and shorts.
"Good to see you're still an asshole, Fazio," Marta said. "Some things never change," Foz said. "Where are your manners, Foz?"
Marta nodded to Del like he was the special on the menu.
"I assume this is your partner now that you're a big homicide dick."
"Del, meet Marta Nikolic. The Nikolic's are two of Seattle's most upstanding citizens."
"How do you work with this guy?" she asked Del.
"It ain't easy sometimes," Del said.
"So what do a couple of big-shot homicide detectives want with a couple of law-abiding citizens such as us?" Marta asked.
Ian Nikolic poured himself a mug of coffee from the stained pot and filched a Camel from his wife's pack.
"Let's sit on the deck."
Del looked like he'd just been asked to jump out of an airplane without a parachute.
"Too hot to sit outside," Foz said. "You know me. I don't tan. I cook."
Nikolic and Marta had begun their careers as skip tracers. Clients paid them thousands of dollars to find people who didn't want to be found, or to locate money others had wrongfully taken. They were so adept at finding people, even the police department had, on occasion, used their services, which was how Foz got to know them. In fact, they'd become so good at finding people, they'd branched out to hiding people. Women in abusive relationships, corporate whistleblowers who feared for their safety, and stool pigeons not interested in entering the Federal Witness Protection Program and spending the rest of their lives living in a Midwest suburb as some everyday Joe. For the most part, they kept their noses clean, but getting information often required ingenuity that bordered on illegal. Nick spoke to Marta.
"He wants to know if we've heard anything about the woman who died on Mount Rainier and showed up in a crab pot in Puget Sound."
"Wondering if anyone was looking for her," Foz said.
"Someone looking for a dead woman," Nikolic said, nodding his head. "Not a bad place to start."
Nick and Marta blew smoke out of the corners of their mouths toward the open door.
"If someone around here helped her, they're keeping it quiet, and I don't blame them," Nick said.
"Why is that?" Del asked.
"It's bad for business when your client gets found. Worse if she gets killed," Nikolic said. "Not only is your reputation ruined, you got the police and everybody else knocking down your door."
"What about a husband looking to find his wife?" Foz turned to Del. "What was his name?"
"Graham,"
Del said. "Graham Strickland." "You heard his name or rumors of a husband searching for his missing wife?" Foz asked.
"I haven't, but I can ask around."
"I'd appreciate it."
"Enough to actually pay me?"
Foz smiled. "Unlike you, I can't afford a Ferrari. I'm making payments on a 2010 Subaru."
Nick shook his head.
"The wife was using an alias, Lynn Cora Hoff," Del said.
Nikolic found a pen amid the clutter and wrote it on a piece of paper.
"What was the first name you said?"
"Andrea. Andrea Strickland."
Del spelled the last name.
"Her maiden name was Moreland."
"And while you're at it, ask around about a Devin Chambers," Foz said.
"Hang on, hang on," Nikolic said. "Give me the last name you said."
"Chambers. Devin Chambers," Foz repeated.
"Another alias?"
Nikolic blew smoke toward the sliding glass door.
"A friend who might have helped the wife disappear."
Foz opened up his briefcase.
"I was hoping you could take a look at some documents. Give me your learned opinion."
Foz was playing to Nikolic's large ego. He set his file on one of the desks and pulled out photocopies of Lynn Hoff's birth certificate and the driver's license they'd obtained from the DOL. He handed the photocopies to Nikolic. Nikolic studied each while sipping his coffee and sucking on the cigarette. Marta extinguished her cigarette butt in an ashtray, blew a stream of blue smoke and picked up the photocopies as Nick discarded them. Nick held up the certified copy of the birth certificate.
"Looks legit."
"It appears to be," Foz said.
"Likely a real person, then. It's easier than using a dead person, since they check the death records now."
Nikolic continued to study the copy of the birth certificate.
"The typeset is intaglio printing, which is appropriate for an official document, and the seal looks good. Can't tell you about the paper from photocopies."
He put down his mug and walked to one of the desks, which had a combination light and magnifying glass on the end of a retractable arm. He turned on the light and examined the paper.
"Likely it was quality safety paper, though. If someone had erased or altered anything on the original, you would have seen it on these photocopies."
"You're saying it was a legitimate birth certificate?"
"I'm saying it looks like it, yeah."
"We didn't find a record that a Lynn Cora Hoff is deceased."
"She might not be. Or she might be dead and nobody ever reported it,"
Nikolic said, confirming Foss's suspicion.
"So is the birth certificate stolen?"
Dell asked.
"Stolen, purchased, or given in exchange for some favor," Nikolic said.
"What kind of favor?"
Dell asked.
"The privilege of keeping your finger," Nikolic said. "Organized crime does it all the time. They get somebody under their thumb who owes them money and take their paperwork in exchange for not cutting off a finger. Then they sell the ID to pay off the debt."
"Why would they use a California birth certificate?"
Dell asked.
"Bigger state, more people," Nick said. "If the person who obtains the fake ID doesn't do anything illegal, the real Lynn Cora Hoff would never know someone was using her ID."
Nikolic set down the documents and flicked his cigarette butt, still burning, out the door.
"I can ask around, but if I find anything, you didn't hear it from me."
"We don't even know who you are," Foz said.
"You don't know how much I wish that were true," Nikolic said.
"You'd miss me," Foz said. "Like a bad case of the flu. I'll ask around, though. This one is getting some notoriety. Someone is liable to start bragging about it."
Chapter 19. Los Angeles, California. Tracy pulled to the curb of the Metropolitan Courthouse in downtown Los Angeles.
"So what are you up to today?"
Dan asked, in a tone that made clear to Tracy that he had figured out she wasn't going to be spending the day at some museum.
"An interview," she said.
"Do I want to ask who the interview is with?"
"The aunt of the woman in the crab pot," Tracy said.
"You mean the case in which you no longer have jurisdiction?"
"That would be the one."
"So how are you going to justify it?"
"Thorough police work," Tracy said. Dan gave her a look like he wasn't buying it. "Nolasco said to wrap up what we were working on. I was working on an interview with the aunt. I'll talk to her, write it up, and ship it down to Tacoma."
"And how far do you think that will get you if he finds out about it?"
"Let's hope I don't have to make that argument," she said. "Seriously, though, I can say I was in Los Angeles on pleasure, and didn't talk with Patricia Orr in an official capacity as a Seattle police officer."
"Let's hope you never have to make that argument either," Dan said.
She smiled. "I'll plan on being back around 4. Dan kissed her.
"Wish me luck."
"I'm the one driving in Los Angeles. You should be wishing me luck." She jumped on the I-10 East and settled into a steady stream of traffic. 10 years ago, she would have been dismayed at the sheer number of cars, but with Seattle the fastest-growing city in the nation, traffic had also become a way of life in the Northwest. So had a drought all along the West Coast, and it had hit Southern California hard, especially with the recent heat wave. The hills had turned a dirt brown, and the sky a rust-colored haze. It reminded Tracy of the grainy images the Mars rover had transmitted back to Earth, and it looked like the slightest spark would cause everything to burst into flames. Just under an hour into her drive, she merged onto I-215 North to San Bernardino,
one of Southern California's sprawling cities, which had become infamous in 2012 as the largest city in the United States to declare bankruptcy, and then again in 2015 when two radicalized Islamic losers killed 14 innocent people. She exited onto East Orange Show Road and turned right onto South Waterman Avenue. Her GPS directed her onto 3rd Street, and she slowed when the voice informed her that her destination, a beige stucco apartment complex, was on her right. She turned into the parking lot and pulled into a spot abutting a wrought iron fence, enclosing an amoeba-shaped swimming pool. Two palm trees towered over the pool, but offered little shade. She slipped on sunglasses and exited the car. As she ascended an outdoor staircase to the 2nd story and made her way down the landing, she heard traditional Mexican music filtering out an open apartment window. When she came to the 2nd door from the end, she knocked. Inside, she heard someone turn off the television and footsteps approach the door, followed by the distinct sound of a chain sliding from a lock and a deadbolt disengaging. A woman answered. "Mrs. Orr?" Tracy said. "You must be the detective from Seattle. Call me Penny," she said. Tracy introduced herself. She estimated Orr to be early 50s. Though she was in good shape, trim, with defined arms, she had a heaviness to her that Tracy usually associated with someone who'd lived a hard life and felt the weight of it. Orr had dark Irish coloring, freckled, pale skin with dark hair that showed just a few strands of gray. "Come in, please. You made good time," Patricia Orr said. "Traffic must have not been too bad." "Not too bad," Tracy said. She'd called the night before and spoken to Orr, letting her know the purpose of her visit. She stepped into a modestly furnished but impeccably clean apartment with cream-colored leather furniture, a few bronze sculptures, and large framed prints. In one print, 3 Elvis Presleys dressed in cowboy garb aimed 6-shooters into the living room. In another, multiple colorful images of a forever young Marilyn Monroe winked seductively from behind the leaves of a potted fern. "Andy Warhol," Tracy said. "That Elvis is one of my favorite prints." "Are you a fan?" Patricia Orr asked. "I'm a shooter," Tracy said. "My sister and I competed in shooting tournaments all over the Pacific Northwest."
"Do you and your sister still compete?"
"I still get out every so often," Tracy said. "My sister passed away many years ago."
"I'm sorry," Orr said. "Please sit."
She motioned to the L-shaped couch facing a large flat screen. To the right, a sliding glass door offered a view to the simmering foothills. Orr reached for a pitcher on the coffee table.
"Can I pour you some iced tea?"
"That would be great, thank you." They made small talk, then settled in. "I'm very sorry about your niece," Tracy said.
"I didn't know what to feel when you called," Orr said. "I'd already grieved Andrea's death once. Then to find out she'd been alive."
She shook her head, as if confused.
"And now she's dead again. It just pains me to think that someone would be so cruel. I hope she didn't suffer."
"It doesn't appear to be the case," Tracy said, not really knowing, but knowing what Orr wanted to hear. The autopsy did not reveal any telltale signs of torture or abuse, and the bullet to the back of the head would have killed Andrea Strickland instantly.
"Do you know what happened?" Orr asked.
"We're in the process of trying to find out," Tracy said. "Obviously, Andrea did not die on the mountain. Somehow she managed to walk off. What happened after that is not yet known."
"Why would she do that?" Orr asked.
"There's evidence she and her husband were having problems. He'd gotten them into some financial trouble, and there are indications of infidelity."
"He didn't abuse her, did he?"
"We're not aware of any physical abuse," Tracy said, though Brenda Berg had indicated that Andrea Strickland hinted at it.
"The other detective said the husband was a suspect. Is he still a suspect?"
"When was that?" Tracy asked.
When he called. It was a while ago now, maybe a month. It was when they still thought Andrea had died on Mount Rainier.
You haven't spoken to that detective since?
No.
The lack of contact confirmed for Tracy that Fields had not been working the file.
We're exploring several different scenarios, she said. I was hoping to get a little background about your niece. I understand she came to live with you when she was 13.
Or set her iced tea down on a coaster.
It was just before she turned 14.
Your sister and brother-in-law died in a car accident.
Yes, Orr said. Christmas Eve. It was horrific.
And Andrea was also in the car?
Orr nodded. The accident was late at night on a road not well traveled. Andrea was in the back seat and barely injured, but my sister and her husband died on impact. The highway patrolman said it was one of the most gruesome accident scenes he'd witnessed in 20 years.
I'm sorry, Tracy said. How long was Andrea trapped in the car?
Close to 2 hours, Orr said softly. I can't imagine what that was like.
How was she, emotionally, when she came to live with you?
Orr gave the question a bit of thought. Quiet, reserved. She had frequent nightmares.
And you lived here, in San Bernardino?
Not here, in this apartment, a home out near the foothills until the divorce.
She picked up her iced tea and took a sip, avoiding eye contact.
Did Andrea have counseling?
Orr sat back, glass in hand. Her demeanor appeared to have changed, more reticent and closed off.
Yes.
A doctor here in town?
Just a few miles from here.
What was that doctor's name?
Townsend. Alan Townsend.
Do you know if he's still in practice?
I believe he is. I don't know for certain.
Did the counseling help?
Orr shifted her gaze to the floor and shut her eyes, but a tear rolled slowly down her cheek.
Tracy gave her a moment. I'm sorry if this is upsetting, Penny.
Orr nodded, but the tears continued. Then her chest shuddered. Andrea had been through so much, she said. I thought the nightmares were from the accident. I didn't know.
Tracy put it together. The divorce, the reluctance to talk about Andrea's counseling.
Your husband? Tracy asked.
The scenario, unfortunately, all too familiar.
He was abusing Andrea, Orr said. It came out in her counseling. He denied it, said she'd made it up, that she lived in a fantasy world.
What did the counselor say?
It was his opinion Andrea was telling the truth. The allegation required that he contact Child Protective Services. They removed Andrea from our home. I moved out because it was quicker than waiting for the divorce to become final, and found a place on my own, a small townhome. Andrea had been sent to another home until eventually she came back to live with me.
Did you determine the truth? Tracy asked.
Andrea was telling the truth.
I'm sorry. Did you become Andrea's legal guardian?
Yes. My sister and brother-in-law had it in their will, and the probate court had a hearing, and the judge appointed me.
So you could authorize the release of Andrea's counseling records?
I could, Orr said.
But why would you need them?
We're exploring every potential reason why Andrea walked off that mountain, trying to understand what happened. The records might help.
How was she, psychologically, when she came back to live with you?
Worse, Orr said. She became very withdrawn, very nervous. She'd pick at her skin and compulsively bite her fingernails, sometimes until they bled. She also read constantly, everything she could get her hands on.
Novels? Tracy asked. Any specific genre?
No, just everything and anything. Westerns, romance, sci-fi, fantasy, mysteries, detective novels. Everything. I would take boxes of paperbacks to the used bookstore every month and trade them in for another stack.
What did her counselor have to say about Andrea reading so much?
He said Andrea had withdrawn from the real world because the real world was too painful. He said books offered her comfort.
Did she make much progress?
In counseling?
Some, but she left San Bernardino when she turned 18. I came home from work one day and she was gone. She left a note thanking me and saying she needed a change of scenery.
She didn't tell you she was leaving?
Or shook her head.
I understood, she said softly. Andrea needed to make a life for herself, whatever that was going to be. She needed to get away from here, away from the memories. I understood that.
Did she tell you where she was going?
She said she wanted to live in Portland or Seattle because it rained all the time and she could read. She said she would contact me when she'd settled.
Did you speak to her after she left?
Yes. She kept her word. Said she'd settled in Portland and assured me she was fine. She called a couple of times after that, but not too much.
Or paused.
I really tried to do what was right for Andrea and for my sister.
I'm sure you did.
When I found out my husband had been abusing her, I felt like I'd failed them both. I guess Andrea was just too emotionally scarred, and living here reminded her of those scars. I was part of those bad memories. I just think she needed to get away.
I'm sure you did your best, Tracy said.
I tried,
Orr said. Did Andrea gain control of her trust fund when she turned 18?
No, at 21 she got say over the use of the interest. My sister and brother-in-law originally set it up to pay for Andrea's college. When they died, the rest of their estate rolled into that trust, but it had restrictions. It could only be used for Andrea's well-being.
Were you the trustee?
No, there was a professional trustee. It was very complicated. When she lived with me, I had the trustee roll the interest back into the trust. I never touched a dime. I wanted that to be hers, something good that came out of such a tragedy. Do you know what happened to it?
That's one of the things we're trying to find out. It appears Andrea was in the process of hiding it.
From who?
We think her husband. We think that was one source of tension in their marriage. Apparently he wanted to use the trust to pay off his business debts, and Andrea had refused.
The trust wouldn't allow that, Orr said.
I think that was the reason for the tension.
So you think he might have killed her to try to get control of the money?
We don't know, Tracy said. She changed the subject. Penny, have you ever heard the name Lynn Hoff? Orr's face scrunched in thought.
I don't think so. Who is she?
It appears to be the alias Andrea was using when she was in hiding. Sometimes people will use a name familiar to them, maybe a childhood friend who died or a relative.
No, Orr said. It isn't familiar. Maybe a character from a book?
Maybe. Did Andrea have any close friends when she lived here? High school friends?
Orr shook her head. Not really, she shrugged. At least no one that I'm aware of. She didn't like school. Andrea wasn't dumb. Don't misinterpret what I'm saying. She had her father's intellect, and she was curious about things. I think that's why she liked to read all the time. She retained everything she read on a subject. At the parent-teacher conferences, the teachers would all say the same thing. Andrea was extremely bright, off the charts in some areas, but she didn't apply herself.
Orr shrugged again.
What was I supposed to do, punish her?
She wiped her tears and made a face as if the thought were ridiculous.
She'd been punished enough.
Tracy gave Orr a moment to regain her composure. Then she asked,
I take it she didn't have any boyfriends?
No. And no enemies?
Not that she ever spoke of. She just mostly kept to herself.
You didn't know she'd gotten married? Orr frowned.
No.
You never met her husband?
No, but he doesn't sound like a very good man. Did Andrea ever mention the name Devin Chambers?
Devin Chambers? No, who is he?
She, actually. She appears to have been a friend of Andrea's in Portland. Orr smiled, but it had a sad quality to it.
I'm glad she had someone. She had so much sadness in her life, so much pain.
Tracy thought of Sarah often, of her being subjected to the demented mind of a psychopath the last days of her life. The thought still caused a visceral reaction and brought a dark cloud of bitterness and anger. But she realized something else, something that had never happened before on any of her other cases. She was starting to realize this case wasn't personal because of the victim's similarities to Sarah. It was personal because of Andrea Strickland's similarities to Tracy. Tracy had also had a wonderful life shattered by tragedy. She, too, had been the daughter of a doctor, living in a beautiful house with a mother and sister she loved. Just as suddenly, her sister had been abducted, and her father soon thereafter shot himself. Her husband left, and everything she had thought would be her life changed forever. For years she had medicated her depression by working out and shooting often. But every once in a while, she sat in her apartment, depressed, and wondered why the world had crapped on her.
"Did your ex-husband know about Andrea's trust?"
"Yes," Orr said. "But he's dead, detective. He died 3 years ago of colon cancer."
"What about her trustee? What kind of man is he?"
"He's a wonderful man. If he had wanted to cheat Andrea, he could have done it easily."
"Can you think of anyone else who knew about the trust?"
Orr gave it a moment of thought.
"Not unless Andrea told someone about it."
The comment made Tracy think of Brenda Berg, Devin Chambers, and Andrea's counselor. "I'd like to get Andrea's counseling records," she said. "I'd need a signed letter authorizing their release. Would you do that?"
"I will," Orr said, "with one caveat."
"Sure."
"I see no reason why any of this has to be made public. Andrea was hurt enough in life. I don't see any reason to hurt her after death."
Tracy agreed. Orr called Alan Townsend's office, got his call service, and left a message. Toward the end of Tracy and Orr's conversation, Townsend called back and said he could meet Tracy at his office. They set a time, and Orr signed a letter authorizing the release of Andrea's counseling records. Tracy thanked Orr for her time and handed her a business card as she walked Tracy to the door.
"Do you know who I would contact about her body?" Orr said. "I'd like to have Andrea buried alongside her parents."
Tracy wrote the King County Medical Examiner's phone number on the back of her business card. "They should be ready to release the body," she said. When Tracy opened her car door in the apartment complex parking lot, a blast of searing heat escaped. She waited a moment, then reached in and started the engine, but did not get in. She wanted to give the air conditioning time to do its job. While she waited for the oven to become a car, she thought again of Andrea Strickland and of her uncle. What kind of a person would take in a young girl whose parents had died in a horrific car accident and see it as an opportunity for his own sick and twisted sexual desires? It was another reminder that the psychopaths of the world were not always the stereotypical monsters who tortured cats in their youths and lived in solitude. When the car had cooled, Tracy slid behind the wheel. She left the parking lot and turned on North Waterman Avenue, a four-lane street pocked with palm trees located just around the corner from the St. Bernardine Medical Center. As Tracy had found with most of Southern California, the street consisted of an odd mix of single-family homes, apartment buildings, strip malls, and commercial buildings, as if the city planners had given no consideration to zoning. She parked on the street and approached a two-story, sand-colored stucco building. Alan Townsend's counseling practice was located on the second floor off an outdoor staircase. The inside looked like a small two-bedroom apartment converted to an office, with the front room the waiting area. The furnishings were dated, shag carpeting,
cloth and laminate furniture, and nondescript prints. Behind a vacant reception counter were two closed doors with nameplates. The plate on the right was empty. The plate on the left read A. Townsend. Tracy slapped a bell on the counter, which emitted an obnoxious ting. Seconds later, the door on the left opened and a middle-aged man with a head of silver hair emerged wearing cargo shorts, a T-shirt, and flip-flops. With a skin complexion more orange than bronze, he looked just like the actor George Hamilton. Welcome to L.A. Dr. Townsend? Tracy said. Townsend extended a hand and flashed a smile so bright it almost caused Tracy to put her sunglasses back on.
You must be the detective from Seattle. Come on in.
He turned his back and went into his office.
I don't usually work on Friday, so I'm operating without a receptionist. You'll have to excuse me if I look a little disorganized.
I'm sorry to bother you on your day off.
Not a bother, he said. I understand the circumstances. Besides, I've already had a full day. Friday mornings I surf and do a little meditating. I thought I'd get some work done in an air-conditioned office while waiting out the heat. I play tennis in the evenings.
Surfing around here?
The ocean is an hour and a half. That's why I only do it once a week, and I go early. It's exhilarating.
Sounds like a good day.
Every day we're alive is a good day, he said.
This guy made actors on Sesame Street seem depressed.
The back wall was a window facing east toward the San Bernardino Hills. The wall to Tracy's left was the ego wall, with framed diplomas and citations, some partially obscured by the leaves of a collection of potted ferns, cacti, palms, and a peace lily. Townsend had a modest desk beneath the diplomas. He took a seat in a leather chair, leaving Tracy to sit on a two-seat couch. On the wall beside the window was a framed quote, "Who looks outside, dreams. Who looks inside, awakes." Carl Jung. The room smelled of incense. Tracy handed Townsend the signed authorization from Patricia Orr for the release of Andrea's records, which was valid because Andrea had been a minor when she received counseling.
I was hoping to get your impressions.
Well, first off, I can tell you I was not surprised to hear Andrea had died in an accident on Mount Rainier.
Apparently, Townsend did not know Andrea had not died on Rainier. Tracy decided to explore his thinking. No? Why not?
Because I was not convinced it was an accident.
You thought the husband killed her?
No, I would maintain that Andrea took her own life.
Why would you come to that conclusion?
Because of 3 years of therapy. This would be the kind of grandiose gesture I'd expect Andrea would choose to leave the world. Something to let the world know she'd been here.
Grandiose?
I understood from Mrs. Orr that Andrea was an introvert who hid from the world. That was her coping mechanism, Townsend said. That was how Andrea chose to hide from her problems, to shut them away in a closet, so to speak. But that wasn't who she really was.
Tracy knew that trick very well.
She'd become obsessed with finding Sarah's killer, so much so that when she'd finally had to walk away, she'd had to literally shut Sarah's files in her bedroom closet so that she could function.
How would you describe her?
Before the car accident that took her parents' lives and before the abuse at the hands of her uncle, she was described by her schoolteachers and counselors as a bright, well-adjusted, mischievous young woman.
Mischievous?
She liked to play pranks on her classmates and friends.
What kind of pranks?
Oh, she'd hide someone's lunch, short-sheet their beds at slumber parties, put pinholes in the milk cartons so when classmates drank, the milk would dribble down their chins.
Tracy's sister had been similarly mischievous. Sarah had liked to hide and jump out at Tracy and her unsuspecting friends.
Harmless pranks, she said.
For the most part.
Were there occasions when the pranks were not harmless?
Townsend nodded.
A few, apparently.
Such as?
She cut the stem of a bike tire on a classmate who she believed had been mean to a friend of hers.
Tracy considered this.
Could her pranks have increased in their vindictiveness?
Yes, Townsend said. I believe they could have.
What was your diagnosis for Andrea?
Well, Andrea left when she was 18, so I can't say for certain.
You don't know?
I believe Andrea was susceptible to a dissociative disorder brought on by the trauma and abuse.
What do you mean by a dissociative disorder?
It can be a number of things. In Andrea's case, it could have manifested in an involuntary and unhealthy escape from reality.
Her excessive reading?
Certainly. It's a mechanism used to keep traumatic memories at bay. The person either has memory loss, you can't recall what you did or who certain people are in your life, or she can take on alternate identities.
Split personalities?
In a sense. The person switches to an alternate identity. Someone suffering from a dissociative identity disorder will say they feel the presence of people talking or living inside their head, and they can't control what those people are doing or saying.
You said susceptible. You don't know if Andrea had a dissociative disorder?
Not with certainty. The typical onset is early 20s. She'd left counseling by then.
How would it have manifested if she'd had it?
A number of different ways. For one, the person can be prone to mood swings and impulsive acts.
Would an impulsive act be getting married after just a few weeks?
It could be.
Are these people capable of committing harmful acts?
Suicide attempts are not uncommon.
I meant harmful acts against others.
Certainly.
What can trigger it?
Again, it can be several things. Another traumatic event, abuse or a perceived abandonment, a betrayal, or just a feeling of desperation.
Tracy didn't need Townsend to explain that. In those categories, Andrea Strickland had been a perfect 4 for 4. Were you aware that Andrea had a trust, Doctor?
Andrea mentioned it, he said,
and then looked doubtful.
Or it could have been her aunt said something in passing.
He paused. Then he said,
I believe it was the aunt. She said she was grateful Andrea would, at least, always be financially taken care of. Frankly, I was uncertain whether that was a good thing.
Why is that?
Given Andrea's uncertain future mental state, the trust would have made it easy for her to not work and potentially to engage in an unhealthy lifestyle.
Drugs? Tracy said, thinking of the pot store, Genesis.
Potentially.
And the trust could have also made her susceptible to persons hoping to take advantage of her, could it not?
Yes, he said. It could have. If they knew of it, of course.
Of course.
Chapter 20. On a Friday night, Devon persuaded me to go out after work. I'd made the mistake of telling her Graham had gone to a bachelor party in Las Vegas for the weekend, which meant I couldn't use him as an excuse to get home. With Graham unemployed, he was around the loft almost all day and most nights. Having my job back felt like a reprieve from having to spend time with him. I left for work early and didn't come home until late. Often I would take the current novel I was reading and my laptop to a coffee house with wireless internet access. If I stayed out late enough, I could return home to find Graham passed out, avoid the perfunctory conversations, and sneak off to bed, letting him sleep on the couch. I was counting the days until our Rainier trip. With Graham in Las Vegas, I'd have the loft to myself the entire weekend. What I really wanted was to go home and continue planning without having to sneak behind Graham's back. But I decided that I owed it to Devon to spend a few hours with her.
I'd dumped a lot of my personal problems on her, and she'd always been there to listen.